I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the case of that Chinese human rights lawyer who sought protection from the U.S. is causing a stir in diplomatic circles. But we wondered what Chinese Americans and expatriates have to say about it. So we've called upon the host of a Chinese language talk show based in the U.S. to tell us more about what her listeners are saying. We'll have that conversation in just a few minutes. But first, we want to take a look at those new unemployment figures that came out on Friday. On Friday, the Labor Department released the jobs numbers for April, and they were, not to put too fine a point on it, disappointing. Only 115,000 jobs were created, a lot less than most economists had been expecting. The unemployment rate did edge down to 8.1%, but that seems to be because the number of people looking for work is shrinking. We wanted to talk about what this means for the economy overall, but also how communities of color are faring in the latest jobs report, because those groups have been among the hardest hit by unemployment. In a moment, we will hear from the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver. He and the caucus have made job creation a priority, and we want to hear what he has to say about the latest report. But first, we turn to NPR business editor Marilyn Geewax. Marilyn, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi, Michelle.
What do these numbers tell us about the state of the economy overall right now?
Well, here's what we learned from that latest Labor Department report. This spring, it's just disappointing, lackluster. Now, there is some good news out there. The country has had 26 straight months of job growth, so that's good. And private employers last month added about 130,000 jobs. Some specific industries are doing pretty well. Manufacturing is still growing. Tech firms, farms are doing okay. The energy sector is pretty good. But we've seen a lot of state and local governments cutting back because of these budget cuts. So in April, governments eliminated about 15,000 jobs. That's kind of just a wet blanket on the economy. That's 15,000 people who are not going to go to restaurants, probably won't be taking vacations. So here's the big picture. Jobs are growing, but the momentum is too slow. So as a result, we have about 12.5 million people who are seeking work, and the average length of unemployment is more than 9 months.
What do we know about who is most affected by this? You remember at the beginning of the recession, many people were calling it a man session because it seemed that men or jobs that seemed to be dominated by men, like construction, were the most heavily affected. Has that changed? Who is most affected now by unemployment?
Well, that's what at first it was manufacturers and home construction. So it was really that joke about the man session was going on. But at this point, it's sort of disproportionately hitting at women and African Americans, especially because of the loss of these state and local government jobs. So we've seen teachers, social workers, police officers, and of course, postal workers are getting cut. And that's really the backbone of the black middle class in this country. So the overall unemployment rate is 8.1% for African Americans, 13%. And the other group that's hurting too, though, Michelle, is all young people. People in their early 20s are really getting hurt. They're just not getting in the door. So their unemployment rate is about 13% also. And all of this comes together, and it means a lot of people are just dropping out. Last month, we saw about 342,000 people just left the labor market.
And that was going to be my last question before I turn to Congressman Cleaver, is that we hear about discouraged workers. We hear that part of the reason that the overall unemployment rate has gone down is that a number of workers are not actively looking, that they've gotten discouraged. What do we know about that? And who are these people? Are these primarily the younger folks, or is this across the board of all the groups that you've been talking about?
Let me just say that some of the dropping out is not that bad, in the sense that some baby boomers are getting older. They get to 62 or so, and they just start retiring. They're taking their Social Security benefits. And there are some people who we've seen a big spike in disability. A lot of people are just moving on to Social Security disability benefits. A lot of women are starting to stay home to take care of elderly parents and children. And some of it is young people choose to go back to school to get a little more education. But way, way too much of it is for all the wrong reasons. These are the people who are becoming discouraged, so they apply for food stamps. We've seen a real spike in that because they just don't see any jobs out there. So they're sort of hunkering down, clustering together with families. We've seen a lot of increase in multi-generational households where everybody's just getting together to try to survive. And none of that is good for the economy.
We're talking about the latest jobs numbers. They came out on Friday. I'm speaking with NPR's business editor, Marilyn Geewax. Now I'd like to turn to Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver. He represents Missouri's 5th District. He's also the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, which has made unemployment a priority. Welcome back to the program.
Also, good to be here with you.
Thank you so much. What of these figures, what of this report most concerns you?
Well, first of all, I we have to look at the overall progress that we're making. I think the president can be very proud of the fact that for 26 consecutive months, we have seen job creation. Actually, over the last 5 months, we've seen 1 million new jobs created and about 4 million over the last 26 months. But here's the problem. African-American unemployment is still showing a great deal of volatility. And although African-American women are seeing their numbers drop in terms of unemployment, the men are almost remaining stagnant. And, you know, I'm constantly asked, well, why? And you know, one of the problems is that there's no background music to solving the black unemployment problem. One of the things that troubles me is that corporations, the large corporations, are making record profits, but they are not hiring. And so they're just piling up reserve dollars without hiring.
What do you – I know you just got back from a week of travel across the country where – to cities across the country, not just in your district where presumably this issue came up. What are people telling you about, you know, their spirits, their attitude, you know, about this? What do you sense out there?
I spoke with a guy in Cleveland, African-American, with a master's degree who was telling me he was going to go and try to do an unpaid internship, that he had been out working. But that he was giving up until maybe something happened out in the world that would show that he has a chance to get a job. It's the labor participation rate. That's what we call it, the labor participation rate, which means people going into the market looking for jobs, is down. And that's because of frustration. People are just saying, I've been out here, you know, for 2 years looking for a job. I can't get one unless I work at a fast food joint. And many people are saying, you know, look, you know, I can't even survive on that.
What are you hearing when you talk to your colleagues across the aisle? Because one of the things that seems to have occurred in this country is, and as we, you know, we've just seen elections in France and in Greece where very, you know, different, very sharply different sort of philosophical perspectives on the best way to address lagging economies were the issue. When you talk to your colleagues across the aisle, you know, about what you see, do you see any sign of a meeting of the minds about the appropriate way to address, you know, these issues in this country?
No. My colleagues, good and decent people, but there's a disconnect. And the disconnect is that they believe that if we can simply reduce the tax rate, the corporate tax rates, and give more and more tax cuts to corporations, that they will hire. And of course, if there was truth in that, then we never would have gone into the recession in the first place. Because when George Bush came into power, he immediately did a tax cut, and then 2 years later, after we had entered into the war, there was another tax cut. And if the logic is give tax cuts and things will explode economically in a good way, then we never would have gone into recession. So we're having difficulty. One of the reasons that corporations are not hiring, there are a lot of reasons, but one of them is that because they are operating much more efficiently, and also technology has eliminated the need for some jobs. And the only way we're going to reduce the black unemployment rate is to do training, job training, so that we will have a workforce that can match the technological advances in the corporate world. And until that happens, we're not going to be able to solve the problem. And the other side, I'm a Democrat, the other side just believes in tax cuts.
Well, some argue it's also uncertainty, that uncertainty is political uncertainty leads to economic uncertainty, and that people aren't sure on how much investment that they should make because they're not sure kind of what the business environment is going to be, you know, a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now. And of course, it's an election year where there's the added uncertainty. Do you credit that argument that that's also part of a lag on growth?
I do believe that there are some corporations who believe that, you know, they need to see greater stability in the government. But they are in many ways helping to generate the instability and by a series of things. Number one, many of them are participating in the super PACs, which is going to create a higher level of polarization in Congress. and we're going to have ideological differences rising even in the next Congress, I believe. And I do think that it would be good if everybody knew in the next year this is going to happen. But it, you know, it's there is no stability, and the public needs to understand that there's no stability, and it's because of the people who are elected.
Well, Congressman, we only have a minute left. I want to give Marilyn one more thought, but can I just ask you, as a political leader yourself, are there any steps that you can personally take yourself or within the caucus to try to contribute to an atmosphere of, you know, bipartisanship that might address this?
Well, yes. First of all, I was a part of the group that organized 100 members of Congress, 50 Democrats, 50 Republicans, who called a press conference and announced that we were supporting a combined bipartisan way to deal with the deficit. We had all the news media there. Nobody would report it because we weren't fighting. And so that was troublesome. We said we were going to support Simpson-Bowles. No coverage at all.
A debt relief, an effort to cut the deficit. Well, I take your criticism, Congressman. I understand what you're saying, and I thank you for joining us. Marilyn, final thought from you very briefly.
Just that we have more trouble to come with Congress in that a lot of tax cuts are expiring. There are big issues towards the end of the year. So the things that are a problem now are likely to get worse in terms of being a damper on the economy because of this uncertainty.
That's NPR business editor Marilyn Geewax here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Also with us, Congressman Emanuel Cleaver. He represents Missouri's 5th District. He's also the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus and just returned from a cross-country listening tour. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
It's nice to be here.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, you may think you love action, adventure, and fantasy movies, but do you love your favorite characters enough to live as one of them for a weekend? We go into the world of superhero and fantasy role play. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we want to turn to the case of the Chinese human rights activist Chen Guangcheng. He is the dissident whose escape from house arrest and later request for American protection dominated the news during Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's visit to China last week. And of course, his escape was made all the more remarkable by the fact that he is blind. Chinese and U.S. officials are currently talking about plans for Chen to study in the United States. The Chinese government said Friday that it would allow Chen to apply to study overseas, but as of today, reports indicate that he is still in a Beijing hospital surrounded by security officials. The case has raised serious diplomatic tensions between the U.S. and China, but we found ourselves wondering about the kind of conversations Chinese Americans are having. So we've called upon Sherry Zhang. She is the host of a live Mandarin language talk show in San Francisco, California, and her listeners have been talking about that with her, so we've called her. Sherry, thank you so much for speaking with us again.
Thank you, Michelle, for having me.
What is the tenor of the conversations that your listeners have been having with you? Are they angry? And if I can ask this, who do they side with in this?
Similar to before, when there are human rights issues on the table, there are two sides. One side is being very sympathetic.
Sympathetic to whom?
The victims. Like this time, it's a Chen Guangcheng, who actually is blind, like you said. At the meantime, that his rights being taken away from him, his basic human rights, and also he's got beaten and his family got beaten up by the policemen and all that. So one side is being very sympathetic. The other side is always stand along the line of the Chinese state media, critical of the U.S. and saying U.S. is meddling with the Chinese affair, and also critical of Chen Guangcheng saying that he's demanding too much, he's making the country look bad and all of that. Although the difference between this time and the previous ones were a lot more people being more sympathetic because the victim is blind.
Mr. Chen has been speaking with the Western press throughout this ordeal, and I just want to play a short clip of his remarks translated for an NPR report last week. Here it is.
There are lots of problems, which means that I want to go to the U.S. as soon as possible for treatment. I hope Clinton can help get passports for me and my family.
There's a sort of a portion of your listeners who are annoyed. They feel that the U.S. is meddling in China's internal affairs and that they are concerned that this case is making China look bad. I think that that might be surprising to some people because I think that there are those who would assume that people who are Chinese Americans or people who are living, you know, in the United States are critical of the kind of the Chinese government. And that's not the case.
Actually, there are some people like that, although that according to a Jamestown Foundation's report a few years ago, the Chinese government either control or influence more than 90% of the media, the Chinese media, in the United States. So actually, a lot of Chinese either read or watch or listen to the Chinese media, even though they're in the U.S. So they're very influenced by the state media.
So Chinese speakers who are still consuming news in Chinese national languages are consuming state-run media. Do they know that they are?
Most of the time, they don't. They thought that all the media are like that, and that's the public opinion.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with Sherry Zhang. She is the host of a Mandarin language talk program. We're talking about the case of the human rights activist Cheng Guangcheng, and we're talking about reaction among her listeners. And I think the way this is being described in the English language media, some are saying that it's forcing the Obama administration to choose between U.S. economic interests and U.S. democratic principles. And I'm wondering if the people who are calling your programs see it that way as well.
Yes, they do see it that way as well. It's not a secret that the U.S. government pays a lot of attention to the economic development with the Chinese government to form some kind of partnership. Although that because that the Obama government, especially President Obama, he has made a lot of very, very nice speeches in the past and talking a lot about human rights. So I think there are a lot of Chinese has really high hope on the U.S. government helping them with their human rights issues. They keep their hopes high, and sometimes they get very disappointed.
People who have been interested in speaking out about China's human rights record, particularly expatriates or immigrants, have not been so vocal in recent years. But do you sense that that's changing in this particular case?
I think in this particular case, a lot of people really feel for Mr. Cheng Guangcheng because he's so courageous and he's blind. And also, this case is more clear-cut human rights issue. I see a lot of very strong reactions on his case, and a lot of dissidents are speaking out for him. So compared to past human rights issues, somehow this one, you see a lot more response.
Mr. Chen is the second prominent figure this year to seek refuge at a U.S. consulate in China. The first was a politician and former police chief. Did that case resonate in the same way? And it is worth noting that it was not handled in the same way. The U.S. declined to offer this individual a refuge.
He has done many bad things in the past. Particularly, I have seen reports saying that he participated in taking people's organs for transplant and some from live people. But it's very interesting that he also ran into the U.S. consulate to seek for asylum. So his case is very different than Cheng Guangcheng's case.
I know, but Sherry, I have to ask, though, because we are now seeing in state-run media reports of inappropriate things that Mr. Chen is alleged to have done. For example, our correspondent Louisa Lim reported that there are now reports that he was charging people for water and all these other accusations. And she's describing this as an effort to demonize him. And so I'm wondering now whether are people looking at Mr. Chen with skeptical eyes as well?
You would see some Chinese would believe in that state media's report. But that tactic is actually no surprise to me. The Chinese government's very good at finding things to discredit people and usually try to make the public opinion, swing the public opinion. But now they're losing credibilities, and I think less and less people would believe in what they're saying.
And finally, Sherry, before we let you go, and thank you for taking the time again to talk with us, Mr. Chen, as we've discussed, and along with his family, is seeking refuge in the United States where he would hope to study. And I'm asking you, I apologize to predict, but how do you think he'll be received?
I think he will be received warmly just because that Even though I said there are two sides of opinions, I see a vast majority of people being supportive of him and being feeling very sympathetic for him, and that's really a major majority. So I think in his case, he should feel very comfortable in this Chinese community overseas, and particularly in San Francisco, in the U.S. I think there will always be some people being critical. But I think it's okay. I think majority of people he would feel very comfortable with.
Sherry Zhang is the host of a Mandarin language call-in talk show based in San Francisco, California, and she was kind enough to join us from the studios of Stanford University. Sherry, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
Now it's time to open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine. That's something we do just about every week for interesting stories about the way we live now. And over the weekend, many fans flocked to the theaters to see the comic book classic-turned-movie, The Avengers. The film brought in more than $200 million in its opening weekend. That's a record for any movie's first 3 days.
Dr. Banner, your work is unparalleled, and I'm a huge fan of the way you lose control and turn into an enormous green rage monster.
Thanks.
So don't be shocked when your friends and neighbors start showing up places dressed like characters from the movie, because Iron Man, Captain America, the Hulk, and Thor have actually been taking over trade show conventions like Comic-Con and PAX East for years. Our next guest recently attended one such convention on a much smaller scale. Mysticon takes place every February in Virginia and features activities for gamers, Trekkies, horror fans, and all such folk. Here to tell us more about his experience at Mysticon is writer George Gonzalez. His story, Lost in Space, was featured in this week's Washington Post magazine. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. And I see you're dressed kind of in disguise as like a regular guy. So thanks for that.
These are my day-to-day clothes.
These are your day-to-day clothes.
Yes.
Well, so first of all, who are these people that you call LARPers and Schlarpers?
This was something that I found out about when I went down to the convention at Mysticon. And a LARP is a live-action role player, and it's someone who creates their own character and acts out that character's ideas or thoughts with other LARPers. And Schlarpers are superhero live-action role players who are the same thing but with a superhero edge.
A Schlarper was recently in the news in this area because he dressed as Batman, and he was, of course, stopped in traffic because apparently he was trying to stop crime or something. And then there was another example where somebody else there were a couple of people who've kind of run afoul of law enforcement because they actually were attempting to stop crime or, you know, and act out their role fully. Most of the people that you met at the convention, they don't do that, right? Or they limit their role play to conventions like this.
I believe so, yes.
That's a good diplomatic answer. Well, what attracts people to this?
I think it's an opportunity to just unleash your imagination. When people go to these conventions, they really can do whatever they want, you know, within means. But they're really there to interact with other people, other enthusiasts who are really into the same ideas that most other people aren't even aware of.
How do people get started on this? I mean, you noted yourself that you're a gamer. So you're kind of interested in where gaming fits into this, and gamers are part of this community. But the people you met who really, you know, immersed in it, particularly the role players, how did they get started?
They usually said that they got involved because someone else told them about it. And they said, I was talking to this one guy who said, hey, you know, when I was in high school, there were these kind of weird people who introduced me to this new concept of playing games. And it's real social. It's an opportunity to interact with people and talk and do whatever you want.
Was it mainly male or female, or was it pretty mixed?
It seemed pretty mixed. I expected more of a male dominance, but there were a good number of women there as well.
You know, is this really any different in a way from kind of Renaissance, you know, weekends? I mean, there's a huge in this area also like a Renaissance festival where people kind of dress up in medieval garb and do medieval things. Is this along the same lines?
I think it's the same thing, yeah, except it has more of a sci-fi bent to it.
Sci-fi bent to it. Now, you actually, in your story, you're not really being mean, but it sounds a little mean.
Oh,
but you talk about a hierarchy of uncoolness and how the people who attend these conventions are often considered, you know, geeks and nerds.
Sure.
But and you say that with love because you consider yourself kind of part of the uncoolness. But in the hierarchy of uncoolness, where did you determine these folks were?
Well, I self-identify as a nerd. I kind of have the classic look of a nerd, where I have glasses, I have poor posture. When I was in high school, I had acne. When I was in high school, I was in the marching band. those people are easy to pick out in a crowd. You can see them and be like, yeah, that guy's a nerd. That guy's a dork. But the same hierarchy exists for people who are into science fiction and horror stuff and fantasy stuff. And generally, you have people who play video games. And they're generally accepted because you have everyone knows who gamers are. Like, they're playing it on their iPhones or on their iPads, or they're on their computers, and they spend a lot of time with it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with writer George Gonzalez. His story about the Mysticon science fiction and fantasy convention was featured in this week's Washington Post magazine. You know, one of the things that was fascinating to me about this is that I think that many people think of people who are very involved in gaming or in fantasy play as being antisocial, that they're engaged in it because they don't want to interact with other people. But one of the things that your story demonstrates is that that's actually not true, that many of these people were very interested in interacting with other people who shared their interests. Was that a surprise to you?
It was very much a surprise. Generally, with people who are so interested and so immersed in their imaginations, it seems to be like a very exclusive activity, like you're not a part of it. So when I went to the convention, I expected to be really detached from it and not get a lot of people reaching out and bringing me in. But that I was totally wrong about that. Everyone gave you an encyclopedic answer for everything. There are no short answers at Mysticon.
One of the other things I was curious about is how did people feel about being written about? Because you can see it from either perspective. You can see where people would be very interested to have people share their experience and understand their experience. And you could also see where people might be a little worried about people making fun of them or not understanding what they're all about.
Yeah, that's something that I figured out when I was down there. No one is like that. I guess people down there at the convention weren't really interested in what you thought about them. They were more interested in playing the game or discussing the game or discussing, you know, A Call of Cthulhu, which is a short story by H.P. Lovecraft, a 20th century horror writer. They were really interested in talking with other people who were like-minded. And if you didn't like those things, they didn't really care.
Well, okay. Finally, before we let you go, you mentioned in the piece that you had kind of an epiphany about these conventions and about the people who would attend them. Can you tell us about that moment?
Yes. There was a chair. There was this man who had a replica of Captain Kirk's chair from Star Trek. And everyone was walking by it and sitting in it and taking pictures in it, and everyone was having a good time. But for me, who's someone who never watched Star Trek, it didn't seem like something I wanted to do. But you know, to come round out my experience at Mysticon, I went back to the chair and I sat in it, and it was actually not as bad as I thought it was.
Okay. Are you tempted now to dress up like Captain Kirk?
Not
you
Captain
can tell
Kirk.
Me, just between us. Just me and the hundreds of thousands of other people listening to your show.
If I had to go back, I'd probably dress up as a Ghostbuster.
Good choice. George Gonzalez is a freelance writer. His story, Lost in Space, was featured in this week's Washington Post magazine, and he was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios in disguise as a regular guy. George Gonzalez, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we hear from a woman whose story is her own, and yet is the story of many young people of the post-colonial world. She grew up in Kenya with a large and sprawling extended family, went to Europe to further her education, and as a young adult developed a friendly but distant relationship with her younger brother, who was a son of the American diaspora. But then that distant brother became the most powerful man in the world. In a new book, And Then Life Happens, Auma Obama sheds light on her relationship with her brother, President Barack Obama, and on the sometimes heartbreaking story of the Obama family in Kenya. Auma Obama now lives in Kenya, where she has set up her own foundation called Sauti Kuu, or Powerful Voices, which seeks to help young people become more economically empowered. And she joins us now from New York. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I read a quote in an old article in the New York Times that said, quote, piecing together Barack Obama's family is like piecing together the world. It's a rich experience, but not easy, unquote. But I think your book goes a long way toward doing that. So could you just briefly explain how you and the president are related, or where you are together on the family tree? How about that?
Well, it's on the level of my father, because we share a father. although his mother was American, Anne, and my mother was Kenyan, hence the same surname.
And you are just a year apart.
Yes, we are.
Well, you know, the way you describe, I think, your father is very moving. But it also conveys, I think, very candidly how difficult a figure he was for you at times to get your arms around. And I think the way you describe him is kind of caught between two worlds. Could you just describe that a little bit for us?
Yes. And actually, that's part of the motivation around the book, because even as a child, I could see that my father was caught between two worlds. And that's the African, more traditional world, and the Western, in this case, more American world that he had gotten to know when he studied. And the thing was that with our patriarchal family structures, where the man is, you know, got to be a certain type of man, he's got to behave a certain way. And then there was the intellectual side of him that was influenced by the Western world, where he really, you know, wanted to be in dialogue with people, whether they're women or men, and not necessarily have to bring out his masculinity more than anything else. He had to struggle with being between the two worlds. And he actually loved our culture in many ways, because he was very, obviously he was very comfortable in it because that's how he grew up. But at the same time, he had adjusted and adapted to the Western culture. But maybe he wasn't necessarily that comfortable. But because that was what one did, he did it. And I watched many occasions and many examples where he was just torn and sometimes just didn't know how to behave, because he was trying to please almost like two masters. And he wasn't very good at juggling, which through the book, I try to understand him. And more the reason why I'm able to understand him is because I go through the same experience. I've kind of learned to juggle through the cultures and the different races, the different languages. And he had that experience as an adult. So he was too much of the one and very well embedded in the other. And that was quite a conflict for him. And I watched that as I was growing up.
I wanted to talk a little bit both about your struggle and his, if you don't mind, because his struggle caused no small amount of pain, particularly for the women in his life. You are the daughter of his first wife.
Yes.
Yes. And then when he went to the U.S. to study, he married President Obama's mother. And he actually wrote, you later learned, to his father, yes, asking permission, which was granted. But then when he moved back to Kenya without President Obama's mother, he then married a third woman who would not accept a plural marriage.
Yes.
You never really got a chance to talk to him about it. So how did you piece together his struggle?
Well, it's not so much about being able to talk to him about it. It's seeing what happened. But one thing I have to correct is very often the impression that is given is that we were a polygamous family and that the different wives were wives that were running in parallel. Actually, I very often joke about it and say that my father was very Western, because, you know, in the Western world, you have people getting married, separating, divorcing, and marrying again. You know, many people are not into they're into their second or third marriage. And he, similarly, when he and my mom separated, because the Lua tradition doesn't really have divorce, and I write about it in my book, so they separate. They were no longer together. So really, he was just a man of the times in terms of the Western world, because he, you know, he was in relationships that didn't work, which for me is not extraordinary. And that's something that I find is sometimes a challenge to relay, because we're in the public eye, because people expect something extraordinary of us, the relatives of my brother, who are just basically very ordinary people with very ordinary, you know, mundane situations and coping mechanisms and experiences. And my father was no exception. You know, the thing that was brilliant about him was his brain. You know, he was a brilliant scholar, but in reality, he was just, you know, just another guy, a regular guy.
Well, you know, I think that's one of the things that's kind of charming about your book is that you're very humble about all of that. You also talk about your own kind of personal struggles and figuring out where to fit in and how to fit in. But one thing that is in your book matches up with those who have read President Obama's memoir is that the two of you, even though you were not raised together, you kind of fell in love immediately, you know, as brother and sister.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, why is that? You both describe it, the meeting, in a similar fashion in which that you kind of met each other and it was instant sibling love. And I wonder, what is it that binds the two of you?
I don't know, you know, and I'm just grateful for it. It just happened that way. And maybe we are very similar in certain ways, that we gravitated towards each other because, you know, we spent a lot of time talking together. You know, he listened a lot to what I had to say. And it was just such a bonus to know that he's my brother and he's part of my family. And he was very familiar in many ways. partly because my father had always talked about him. He was very proud of him, but also because there were just things about him that I could relate very well to. And, you know, I can't explain it beyond that. You know, I'm just lucky. I was lucky.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Auma Obama, and as you might have guessed from her name, she is the sister of President Barack Obama. We're talking about her new memoir, And Then Life Happens. You mentioned in the book, which I thought was also funny, is how when he first was elected to the United States Senate, you really didn't understand what all the fuss was.
Yeah, I didn't. Not at all.
When did you figure it out?
I think it was when I came to the inauguration because of the historic significance. You know, the fact that there were very few black men who had made it to that position. So that was very significant. And I was really, really proud of him. And, you know, I left it at that. That's what he wanted to do. He'd achieved it. He was going to obviously do it well. And that was it, I thought. And then life happened.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. I was going to ask about that. You wrote of that time when he was first elected to the Senate, I was astounded at the effect he had on others. Could you describe that a little bit about what you saw?
Yes, that was amazing because I get along with my brother. I think he's a great guy. We have a lot of fun. You know, I that energy around him, I enjoy that a lot. But I enjoyed it on a personal, individual level. And when he became senator, he spoke at an event, and the people were just, you know, they were seemed to be mesmerized by what he had to say. And that experience of somebody being able to move people so powerfully and really have them believe in that person as somebody who can really make a difference in their lives, you know, I saw it at a level that I'd never seen before. And for me, it was a little bit of a surprise because at the end of the day, he's just my brother. So it was like, okay. Maybe he's a bit more than just my brother, you know?
Yes. But by the time he ran for the presidency, you were clued in by then that this was huge. This was a big deal.
When he ran initially?
For president, yeah.
You just realize it as it goes along. And I think maybe that's a good thing. Because with no expectation, no idea of what was coming, it's like a child who gets an injection for the first time. You know, you don't know it's going to hurt until you've had it and it's over. You know, so, and I don't want to say that in a negative way, as if it's, you know, it was a negative experience. It wasn't at all. It was a very new experience with no idea. We were just participating in something that was happening and we were part of it. And it kind of caught us a lot by surprise, but you just work through it. The experience was really something very, very powerful. And I write about it in the book, how powerful it was, you know.
You mentioned in the book how you wanted to be accessible to the American media as a way to explain a bit of your family background and also because you didn't want them to bother your, you know, elderly relatives, too. Mm-hmm. You know, and you paint, I think, a very moving but also complicated picture of the Kenyan side of the Obama family. I just wondered if you've been worried at all about being misinterpreted or has that happened? I mean, I'm noting, for example, that there's a conservative writer who has taken pains to say, to explain the president's political philosophy by saying that his father was an anti-colonialist and so therefore this is kind of his worldview, even though, as you, of course, note, and as I would think most people know, they spent very little time together. Does that worry you at all?
You know, the book does more than talk just about my brother and my father. It really is a book about my journey. And part of my journey is the experience of diversity, different cultures, being with different types of people, just being able to accommodate and be able to adjust and integrate into situations that are very, very different. And every single family has such diversity in the family. And I think if people read my book, they will recognize, because they're just human stories. And the trouble with many of the books that feel so pressed to explain the Obama family, very often the work is work that is, you know, people are quoting what they're kind of like almost things that they've heard, or they feel this necessity to present us as being something extraordinary or something that has to be different now because we have this really extraordinary person who's made it to such great heights. And what my book is really just trying to say is that, no, we're really very ordinary people, and that's not going to change.
Well, before we let you go, I do want to mention that you feel a sense of mission, in part, which you talk about in the book. I wanted to ask about that. The book concludes with the lines, "I am aware that as an Obama, I now have a real chance to make a difference. For me, a door has opened, and I too want to open doors for others." Tell us a little bit more about how you are doing this in your own work.
Well, what has happened is that I worked for almost 5 years with CARE USA. And after that time, I've now actually just started to work with my own foundation, which I founded a while back, but couldn't really commit that much to. And the young people we work with are underprivileged young people from the urban slums or the poor rural areas. And many of these young people don't believe they exist because they live in such circumstances where they're not considered important. They don't even have an identity. They don't believe in self. And how can you achieve anything if you don't believe in yourself? And a lot of the work we do, and we do use a lot of sports to help young people get some self-esteem, like themselves, and get confidence so that they can actually make decisions around what happens in their lives and make a difference to their lives and hence make a difference to their communities. And that's kind of like the way I feel that I can open doors and make opportunities available. And I'm lucky that with that name, which I really do appreciate, and I know that, you know, I have to honor it in that way, it gives me the possibility to do that. I have a platform.
Auma Obama's memoir, And Then Life Happens, is now available in English, previously published in German, and she was kind enough to join us from our studios in New York City. Auma Obama, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
We'd like to end the program today with the occasional series we call In Your Ear. That's where some of our guests tell us the songs they listen to for a little inspiration. Today we hear from Pastor Corey Brooks of New Beginnings Church in Chicago. We hope you remember him. He was on our program earlier this year to tell us about how he spent several months living on the rooftop of an abandoned motel near his church. He wanted to raise awareness about the crime in that building and raise enough money to tear it down. It took 3 months, but Pastor Brooks met his goal, and the motel was demolished in March. And after his interview, Pastor Corey Brooks told us the songs he was listening to keep his spirits up.
My name is Corey Brooks, and I'm the pastor of New Beginnings Church of Chicago, and this is what I am listening to in my ear. Song that I love is called Freedom Looks Good on Me, and it's by, of course, New Beginnings Church of Chicago. And the reason why I love that song is because it helps people who are in bondage by habits, hurts, and hang-ups to get out of their addictions and know that they can live a life of freedom. Slow music, and I love different types of music, but another song that I love is called Talk About Our Love by Brandy featuring Kanye West.
I swear they got some herb spreading what they heard. I can't give them no burn. I can't be concerned with all that talk. I won't be involved. That's my
I like it because it has a nice funky groove to it, and I know someone's gonna say a pastor shouldn't be listening to that, but it sounds really good and I love it.
Couple of things I can't honor, man. How you listen to a girl that still want a man? Tell me the truth, is that a man or Juana, man? I'm wondering why she ready to go like Wanda then. When we met, you was a V like Madonna, man. Now you in a fear running plays like Donovan. McNabb, before you get in the cab, I traded my cash just to take it back to last summer, man.
Then there's another song that I love. It's a real old song, but it reminds me of when I was growing up in high school by Tony, and it's called Just Me and You.
Just me and you.
Number one, I like it because it is, you know, you can dance to it. but I probably like it secretly. I wouldn't say this in front of my wife. She'd probably kill me. But it just probably reminds me of my first love in high school. You know how you had that first love in high school? And the song is like, it's just me and you. And it's just like a Bonnie and Clyde type thing, us against the world. So I think that's why I like that song.
That was Pastor Corey Brooks telling us what's playing in his ear. And that's our program for today. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.